I'm going to call the meeting to order at 10 o'clock on May 29, 2024. This is our Orange County Workforce Development Board. Thank you all for being here after holiday weekend. Really good, safe Memorial Day weekend. Everybody should have a copy of their packets and their agendas in front of them. We're going to go ahead and get started with the Pledge of Allegiance. I'm going to ask Kathy Boyd to lead us. Stand up.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you so much. All right, we'll go into board member roll call and then brief introductions after that, for the sake of our special guests.
Gloria Alvarado. George Bruchel.
Here.
Kathy Boyd.
Here.
Karen Caswell.
Here.
Rob Claudio.
Here.
Steve Curiel.
Here.
Mike Daniel. Andrew Fahmy. Terry Hanlon.
Here.
Bill Hewitt. Rajesh John. Robert Knowles.
Here.
Annalise Luke.
Present.
Doug Mancioni.
Here.
Thea Felix McLeod.
Here.
Bob Morgan. Thomas Ford.
Here.
And Randy Weber.
Here.
We have quorum.
Thank you so much. Let's come and just go around the table, introduce ourselves, give our name, our affiliation, again, for the sake of our special guests. And let's go ahead and start with.
Good morning, everyone. I'm a new board member. Started just a couple months ago. And I work at Providence Mission Hospital in Mission Viejo. And I have been there for 10 years serving in the capacity of a human resources manager. Happy to be here, too.
My name is Karen Caswell. I also am a new board member, same 2 months ago. I'm the CEO of Bridged Automation, and we're bringing advanced manufacturing education to high schools through a microfactory experience.
Morning, everyone. Robert Knowles, also a recent addition to the board. I represent Edwards Life Sciences, medical device manufacturer here in Irvine. Overseeing their global technical training and learning development.
Doug Mangione, here representing labor. Work with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. I've been on this board for 15 years, I think. Always learning every meeting we come to, we learn more. Happy to be here. Welcome aboard, everyone.
I'm Kathy Boyd. I'm representing Orange County Department of Education, K-12, and then somewhat in the secondary education as well. Post-secondary education, I should say. And I'm trying to remember how long I've been here, but it was before 2020, before COVID. So it must be like 5 years or so. I'm Annalise Wick, serving as your volunteer chair of the board, and I represent small business. I'm co-founder of the Luke's Network, which is a strategic planning, fundraising, and outreach firm. This is my 6th year. First year as chair, was vice chair, and also chair of the Business Services Committee. Thank you all for being here.
Yes, good morning. I'm Rob Claudio, and I'm with the Employment Development Department Workforce Services Branch, and I oversee our workforce services in the Orange County region, and I've been with this board either 16 or 17 years, so I'm fuzzy now.
Very good. Good morning. Todd Sword, Southern California Edison. I'm in our Economic Development Services Group. I cover Orange County, parts of LA County, and now Northern areas as well. So glad to be here. Been on the board longer than I can remember. At least 10, 12 years or something. And again, welcome to the new folks here. Glad to have fresh ideas and minds for us.
Morning, everyone. Steve Curiel, principal for Huntington Beach Adult School, part of Huntington Beach High School District, and we do adult education, part of WIO Title II. And I never can figure out what got my 2 years, 3 years, COVID.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Sherry Hanlam. I'm the regional director for California Department of Rehabilitation. We soon will have a new name coming. So, yes. It's been over 16 years. This is a huge change. It's an act of Congress, which is good. But I think in a few months, we'll see a new name with us. Originally, the main rehabilitation is be associated with drug rehab, alcohol. And every time we go out there, we have to explain this before we say anything. But now with this new name, it kind of set it on. I've been on the board since last year. And our department is, we serve people with disability with a training and finding employment.
Hello, everyone. Randy Wetmer with the Ironworkers Force 16. Been on the board for almost 2 years now. I represent part of the Los Angeles Orange County building trades. And glad to be here.
Hi, everyone. My name is George Boutros. I'm with Orange County Business Council. I'm the government affairs manager there. I've been on this board since the beginning of the year, so it's good to see you all again.
Morning, Francis Boston. I'm the deputy director of the Workforce Development Board.
Nancy Cook, director of the Workforce Development Board.
My name is Monica. I'm with Orange County Community Services, and I'm working in administration.
Nancy Nadeau, and I support Nancy Cook.
Not Nancy.
I'm John Cleveland, Senior Deputy County Counsel.
Yes.
Oh, well, so many familiar faces. And this is the first time I've been in this building for a while. But I used to come here as Doug and Todd know all the time. So
like the old days. Back.
Exactly.
Nancy.
Bring the band back.
Great
to be here.
Thank you.
My name is Danielle Moore. I am with the Employment Development Department at Workforce Service
Branch. I'm here with Rob Plata. My name is Rick Calderon. I'm part of the County Orange Workforce and Economic Development Division team. I'm youth regional grad support team.
Wonderful. I'm Bianca Chapman, I'm also hired a staff specialist serving adults and dislocated workers.
My name is Amanda Cuervo. I also work with the, under Francis and Nancy for the operations unit, the mobile unit.
Okay, wonderful. And got it. Andrew,
want to introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Andrew Beck. I'm a board member and I work at Orange County United Way as their financial security executive director.
Perfect. Thank you, everybody, for indulging us on that. We're going to go ahead and move on to item four on the agenda. Are there any public comments at this time? Okay. Hearing none. We'll move on to the presentations. First, we have item five. We have a Brown Act refresher, which is our annual refresher. And we have our special guest, John Cleveland, introduce himself, Senior Deputy County Council, Office of the County Council. Thank you so much for being here.
Morning. Here to give everyone a Brown Act refresher. It will be a review for many of you. Hopefully you'll learn something new. We're going to talk about basic Brown Act rules, standing in ad hoc committees, meetings and agendas, public participation, violations and enforcement, general BCC concepts, and then we're going to kind of come full circle with a few specifics related to your bylaws. So the Brown Act requires all meetings of public legislative bodies to be open and public. That's the basic rule. And the law turns on a couple of key definitions that we're going to cover. Meetings of legislative bodies must be open and public. The purpose of the Brown Act is to facilitate public participation and curb any potential misuse or secret misdealings of the government. So here's our first definition. The Brown Act applies to a legislative body of a local agency. A legislative body includes the governing board of a local agency or any local board created by statute. And that includes any commission, committee, or board. A local agency includes a county and any board, commissioner, or agency thereof. It does apply to your board. Standing committees of a legislative body are legislative bodies if they meet certain criteria. That includes continuing subject matter jurisdiction or a meeting schedule that's fixed. So here's a quick question. If the standing committee is composed of less than a quorum of the governing body, is it still subject to the Brown Act? Yes, if it has continuing subject matter jurisdiction or has a meeting schedule fixed by formal action of a legislative body. It's important to remember, even if you think you're going to create a small standing committee that's less than your quorum. If it is, in fact, a standing committee, it's going to be subject to the Brown Act and we'll have to go through all the agenda and notice requirements. But there's an exception for ad hoc committees, and the ad hoc word really should be phrased a temporary committee. A temporary committee of a advisor of a legislative body that's formed solely for a limited purpose and it constitutes less than a quorum of the legislative body is not itself subject to the Brown Act. But that temporary advisory committee must serve a limited single purpose, not be perpetual, and be dissolved once its specific task is completed. Legislative bodies get into trouble when they try and form advisory or ad hoc committees that span multiple years and really just keep on going and going. You need to have an end date, a fixed purpose, and need to come to an end. So here's a quick question. If the legislative body creates an ad hoc committee and states that the ad hoc will not have continuing jurisdiction, but it actually does continue, is it subject to the Brown Act? Yes, of course, substance controls over form. So here's the next definition, meetings. The Brown Act applies to meetings. A meeting is a congregation of a majority of the members of the legislative body at a single time and location, including teleconference or via other electronic means that we'll talk about later, to hear, discuss, deliberate, or take action on any item of business within the subject matter jurisdiction of your legislative body. So it's not just taking action, it could be discussing. And if you guys all go out to lunch and you start discussing business within the subject matter jurisdiction of this body, you might inadvertently violate the Brown Act. The defined term meeting includes gatherings where members discuss a subject matter, such as social events, meals that we just discussed, not just where votes are taken. So sometimes you have to watch out for serial meetings. It could be a daisy chain or hub and spoke scenario, a series of communications that ultimately lead to a deliberation amongst the majority of the members could be considered a meeting. That might take the form of emails or maybe chats in the chat room, or of course, just in-person meetings. There's an exception for one-way briefings, and this most commonly comes up with staff. If there's a staff briefing members of the legislative body and they're not conveying the positions of other legislators, that is okay. I just have to be careful not to make the positions of other members known. So let's talk a little bit more about serial meetings and technologies. Serial meetings are prohibited when using electronic communications. When can a prohibited serial meeting occur? Replying all to the email message is the most common. Discussing an issue in an internet chat room, posting a like on social media could even be a kind of up or down on an issue, and that would be a potential violation. Discussing an issue on a platform that features messages that disappear, or using an AI robot to do your dirty work and violate the Brown Act. Yeah, all of these could potentially be Brown Act violations. So there's six narrow exceptions to the definition of meeting, and the caveat with all of these that may apply, they're fact specific and they're narrow, and they all depend on the members not discussing any of the issues within the subject matter jurisdiction of the body during any of the potential exceptions. So individual contacts or conversations between members, such as staff or constituents or consultants, those are permitted. Attendance at a conference that's otherwise open to the public and addresses issues of interest to the general public is okay. Attendance at a community meeting that is open to the public, publicized. Attendance at another meeting of a local agency, assuming that members don't participate. And attendance at purely social or ceremonial occasions. And attendance at an open and notice standing committee meeting, again, provided that you are an observer and not a participant. Each of these is a little fact specific. So if you think you come up with a scenario, you can contact staff and county council, see if it's gonna work. So let's talk a little bit about agendas and meeting notice requirements for regular meetings first. A legislative body needs to post the time and place for meetings in an open location and on the agency's website. The agenda must contain a brief general description of the item of business to be transacted or discussed. That's an important one for you. A cryptic one or two word agenda item isn't sufficient. You need to give members of the public enough notice that they know what you're going to talk about, what's going to be on the agenda, and decide whether they want to come and participate or not. Except as otherwise provided by law, no action or discussion shall be taken on any item not appearing on the posted agenda. This is another really important rule It's very tempting to want to kind of get business done and just get it done, even if it's not on the agenda. The better practice, and really the one that's required by law, is to go ahead and direct staff to put that item that's not agendized on a future agenda and address it at a future date, as opposed to just start discussing, deliberating, or taking action on something that's not on your agenda. So normally you guys are doing regular meetings, but special meetings might come up. A special meeting is generally when you need to take action on a quicker time frame. It needs to be noticed by the presiding officer or majority of the body by posting notice and also delivering that notice to each member of the body and a member of the media who has requested such notice. And the notice requirements go down from 72 hours to 24 hours before the meeting. The call-in notice are similar. They need to have a brief description of all the agenda items, and the legislative body cannot take action on anything that's not otherwise appearing on the agenda. Just to make you aware, there's also allowance for emergency meetings. This is probably not going to come up for you because emergency is defined as work stoppage, coping activity, or other activity that severely impairs the public safety or both. But just know that there is a special emergency meeting provision in the Brown Act. Public participation is a key purpose of the Brown Act. All regular and special meetings need to give members an opportunity to address each item appearing on the agenda. And there needs to be a general public comment for members of the public to discuss anything within your subject matter jurisdiction. All the votes taken need to be open and public, and there's no allowance for secret ballots under the Brown. So this comes up quite a bit. When can an item not appearing on the posted agenda be discussed or acted upon? There are a few narrow exceptions and allowances, but the general rule is no item can be discussed or acted upon unless it's on the agenda. However, members on their own initiative or in response to questions posed by the public can give direction to staff, ask for clarifications, provide a reference, point to other resources that address a member of the public's question, request staff report back or agendize or ask for a future report at another meeting. All of these are permissible. And what happens when the Brown Act is violated? Well, there are criminal penalties. It's incredibly rare, but if a member of the public or a member of the legislature intends to deprive the public of information and knows and has reason to know the public's entitled to receive that information, it could be a misdemeanor. Much more common is civil enforcement. District attorney or any interested person could bring a civil action to prevent future violations or invalidate the action that has occurred in violation of the Brown Act. And attorney's fees can be awarded for the prevailing plaintiff, which itself is a significant deterrent to violating the Brown Act. So let's turn now to some general bylaws concepts that apply to all the county's boards, commissions, and committees. And then we'll turn to your specific bylaws. Generally, the bylaws contain the purpose, duties, and roles, and structure of the board, commission, or council, or committee. The Board of Supervisors is in charge of the county and sets the legislative platform for the county, and BCCs function as advisory councils to that board. Citizen members of BCCs are given an opportunity to participate in local government through their interactions with the BCCs and can participate on advisory councils. Sometimes BCCs want to take action on legislative issues, and it's important to coordinate with the CEO Office of Legislative Affairs that kind of coordinates all the county's legislative efforts. Staff can help any BCC that's interested in advocating one way or another. But what's important is that that advocacy is consistent with the county's overall goals and mission. So let's look at your specific bylaws here. So the purpose, as you know, these are just a couple highlights, but I want to just kind of outline how your BCCs outline your purpose, functions, This board is set up to provide strategic planning, program oversight, evaluation of the workforce development area, serve as a strategic convener, and maintain strong and strategic partnerships with business organizations, chambers of commerce, obviously everyone here. The functions include functioning as a comprehensive economic development strategy committee, development and implementation of public assistance programs, and seeking adoption of policies that are favorable to businesses and employers in Orange County. Your bylaws address the standing and ad hoc committee rules that we discussed earlier. There are the four standing committees that they're aware of, and it also your bylaws also provide for ad hoc committees, and it stresses the rules that we talked about. Ad hoc committees need to be less than a quorum. They need to be set up for time-limited tasks, and the terms of appointment are for limited purposes. The bylaws also discuss the Brown Act to require compliance with the Brown Act. The bylaws say how special and regular meetings need to be noticed and how amendments need to be submitted in writing and made available in compliance with the Brown Act. And what this is really referring to is if you're going to propose amendments to the bylaws to the Board of Supervisors, the bylaw amendments need to be discussed in public, notice and agendized, as opposed to done in like some sort of informal majority meeting. That's it. That's all I have. Does anyone have any questions?
You know what, the only question I have, and this is because I noticed the difference between this board and the other two boards in the county, was during the pandemic, we were having to constantly have meetings every 30 days to continue online meetings because of the health issue. But the other boards didn't have these meetings every 30 days. So I don't know where that came from, but it was like ongoing for us.
Yeah,
if you remember.
Yes.
That was a burden for everyone. But that was the law. That was the law. There were special provisions for remote teleconferencing participation during COVID, but there needed to be findings made every 30 days. And if you didn't need to do business, but there needed to be a meeting within 30 days. That was the rule. And that rule has expired. So we don't have to worry about it.
And you make sure that you add something like a buffer. Because the other two boards didn't have those meetings every 30 days, only this board. It was just interesting to me.
And they continued online.
Yes, and they continued online.
We obey the law here.
Administration, but every board that I was aware of had to go through that process, or maybe they just continued to hold in person. Some chose to do that because the challenges were so cumbersome. Yes.
Well, first of all, thank you for being here, and thank you for the team for always keeping us in compliance, and for everyone. You'll see sometimes in our email communications, please don't reply all, so that kind of triggered that reminder. But sort of related to the question around online meetings, do you envision a time where perhaps a board like ours could be in a position to have a hybrid type of meeting, or do you think that this is always going to be an in-person type of requirement?
That's up to the California legislator.
Yeah.
There seems to be a heavy emphasis on in-person meetings. There are certain limited exceptions for teleconferencing for members of a legislative body, but you have to post the agenda outside your hotel room, for example, and you have to allow members of the public into your hotel room from where you're going to be teleconferencing. Yes. And there's a couple of newer provisions that are very, very fact-specific, and we can talk about it, but if there's a family emergency, maybe twice a year, show good cause, I'd be able to participate as a member. Now the public can call in and participate. That is permissible.
And on the issue of discussing issues that are agendized after the fact or outside the board meeting, is that, if I understand right, we're not supposed to talk about the issues that are on agenda?
Only on the agenda, right? Stick to the agenda.
Always stick to the agenda. But if we wanted to continue conversations, let's say we talked about data that we just shared, employment data, and I want to have a conversation with Gloria after, just can't wait to think of those numbers, if we do something, cooperation, try to get more people jobs, what extent, I mean, is that far, that conversation far between two board members?
You can speak to Gloria, but right. Don't start talking to a majority of the legislative body. Once you go over the majority, then you're holding arguably a meeting. There's a problem.
Yeah.
Okay.
Any other comments or questions?
Thank you.
Hearing none, thank you again for being here.
Thank you so much.
So then we move on to item 6 on the agenda, which is another presentation by one of our special guests. This is our SEDS, which stands for Comprehensive Economic Development Strategy. And this is the overview. And it is a draft, and for that, we will be presented with a SEDS by Dr. Fulbright, the Chief Economic Advisor and Founder and Managing Partner of TCCG. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you. Great to see everybody. It's great to be back, as I said, in this meeting, and presenting once again on the SEDS. It's something we do every 5 years. And it's, you know, obviously things change very rapidly. So I don't know if they'll ever move to more frequently than 5 years, but 5 years, think about that, is a long time. Last time, obviously, COVID was not a part of the discussion. So it shows you that, you know, it's good to revisit these things maybe even more frequently than 5 years. So I think I have about 15 minutes or so, and please interrupt me with questions along the way. I don't want to just make a presentation, but have a discussion. Does the federal government kind of requires this if the EDA is going to make investments in your region? Some places, you assent at like a city level, and I'll get into it a little bit later about why that might be the case. We've always, I think in Orange County, thought we'll do it at the county level and cities can kind of draft in and make use of it as well. Obviously having 34 cities, be a little bit crazy if we had, so including unincorporated areas, 35 different SEDs. So I think we redo this. And it is sort of a roadmap. It talks about progress that's been made, where we're currently at, and then looks forward about, and we'll talk a little bit about the SWOT analysis that's a part of it. And then the biggest reason to do it are these investments. And I was really blown away by the note. I think Nancy and her staff did an amazing job of outreach to cities. I think this is by far a record in terms of the number of projects that we got back. So just to staff here. And obviously, not just COVID, but things have changed quite a bit since 2019. So here's sort of the context. We provide kind of an overview. Orange County is a very diverse economy. It's always 1, 2, or 3 nationally in terms of how diverse our economy is, as measured by the Milken Institute. I'll get a little bit into this. So to qualify for EDA funding, you have to be 2% above the unemployment rate, the national average, and 20% or lower in terms of per capita income. And so for a long time, Orange County, if we looked countywide, or most parts of the county, we wouldn't qualify. So I think I have to give credit to Mike Berwain, if you guys remember Mike, he used to be on this board. He developed this strategy that we called Red Zone. So we went down to the census tract level. So some whole counties qualify. Imperial County is a county that always has very high unemployment rate, low per capita income. Some cities would qualify, a couple in Orange County. But actually the good news is that the number of red zones has gone down over time, but it has kind of spread out. And we'll get to a chart on that in a second. Let me know if I've been too long. So and then this time, there's a lot of alignment with what's called SERF, the Economic Resilience Fund, and now it's called California Jobs First. So we'll talk a little bit about that. There's a lot of overlap between red zones and disinvested communities as defined by the state legislation there. You'll see the goals and strategies that we develop. It does create this framework for EDA funding eligibility. I said it aligns, should align, and it does align with because we took that into account. And there's actually some content in the draft report that you saw. And then finally, it does provide this reference point for the Orange County region and how it nests into the state in terms of workforce needs and workforce investments, specifically the Orange County Workforce Development Board. So here's sort of the report summary. The EDA is quite specific about what you have to have in the report. They actually have added two or three, maybe four things this time versus the last time we did it. So the background and context really looks at the labor market and demographics and population. And that's where we get into the red zone disinvested communities. Climate resilience is one of the new things that the federal government added. And that's a big part actually of the California Jobs First as well. Economic development infrastructure, economic resilience was added. I think that was probably added because of COVID, and we saw some regions and communities were more resilient than others. And I think there's a long-term goal at the state and federal level of building in, figuring out how we can build in economic resilience. SWOT analysis has always been a part of it. The strategic direction action plan, the project proposals submission summary, then the evaluation framework. I just took the same one as the existing one that I think was developed the last time we did the sets. And then there's a bunch of appendices there. So this time, I believe last time we had about 70 red zones. This time it's only 48, which is great news. That's quite a bit of progress. And it shows how Orange County has kind of outperformed the state and nation, especially in terms of employment. That's the big driver here. And of course, it is an expensive place, and we do have higher incomes than average, but we still do have these communities that need investment. You can see here the percent of population living in red zones, which I think are pretty interesting numbers. I think previously Santa Ana had the most population, but you can see actually Tustin is about the same. Westminster actually is 33%. Yes.
And the Tustin one, is that still related to the fact that the red zone was actually the military base?
Partly, yes.
Because it wasn't like, you know, people were living there, but it was like no income people or
right.
No income area.
Yeah, but there are parts of Tustin that do qualify separately. And then the other one, I'm glad you brought that up because I would have forgot. A lot of people would question Irvine, but we take the very technical standards that the federal government gives us, and technically UCI, because of students living there, don't want to exclude them. And then Garden Grove, actually 29%, and La Habra, 20%. So sort of the red zones have shrunk in terms of number, but I've kind of spread out in terms of geography, which is interesting. Yeah.
Are these the only cities with red zones?
Yes.
Would have expected like Stanton. Or...
Yeah, it has made progress, I guess. So economic resilience, we looked at
go back to the slide that has the red zones.
Yeah.
What is happening in Westminster and Garden Grove as far as you can tell? Why?
I think higher unemployment and then lower per capita income. I think that's what qualifies.
Not relevant to immigration and other populations, do you think? Or
could be.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can tell you from EDD, we did a scan years ago when we were looking for where do we need to have our services being provided in these communities. And we had a corridor of high unemployment, people receiving unemployment insurance, economically disadvantaged, and it went from Stanton, Garden Grove, Midway City, parts of Huntington Beach, and I still see, and Westminster, that corridor is still there.
Yeah.
That was some of the data that I provided to Karma, the previous director, about when we were looking at where we needed to be.
Yeah.
It had to do with those populations.
Yeah. Thank you, Matt. Mm-hmm.
So in terms of economic resilience, here's where we stand. Currently, there might be a typo there. That should be February 24. So we'll make that change.
We'll make that change.
Yeah. So you can see here, year over year percent change. And that's numerical change. And then versus February of 2020, where are we at? So it shows what industries have come back stronger. And there's some really interesting, I'll focus mainly on where we're at versus right before COVID started. Overall, we're slightly above in terms of employment. Professional, scientific, and technical services is almost 8% above where we're at. And Orange County has really become a hub of a couple things. That is one of them. Regionally, an interesting thing about Orange County is its geographic location, kind of at the center of Southern California. And so there are industries and occupational groups like professional, scientific, and technical, where when you locate a firm, you want to be able to serve the whole region. And that's why Orange County, for that, and professional and business services as well, has become sort of a hub of that. Most of them are pretty close if they're under 100 here. Healthcare continues to get people, obviously, there's more need for healthcare services during COVID and coming out, so that's above. Educational services is up. We've made a lot of investment in education. Transportation warehousing is up 18%. That is the rise of Amazon, e-commerce, et cetera. It's interesting, in some of the work I do for SCAG at the regional level, it's almost exactly the same percentage in Inland Empire. It's up about 18% versus pre. And that's obviously, they have a huge amount of logistics and warehousing and things like that. Management of companies is a smaller one. There are still a couple lagging. And the biggest one is actually finance and insurance. And that's actually lost about 5% of jobs. And it's still about 7% below where it was entering. And I think you see layoffs occurring amongst financial services firms. And we'll get into a little bit into AI. That will probably continue in something like financial services. Any questions on that before we go to the next slide?
Yes. Yeah, bringing the percents right. So when you see 100%, that's double the employment in that area.
100%. Oh, 100% means if it's exactly 100%, it's exactly where it was pre-COVID.
Oh, okay.
And so this is saying we're a 0.5% above. And so the ones that are below 100 still haven't recovered all the jobs lost during COVID. And we forget if you look at most of the charts, that rise in unemployment was, in Orange County, about 10% within like 3 months or so.
It's a pretty big jump in educational services. Any idea how that happened? Or
I think just more investments, Kathy. The state is making a tremendous amount of investments.
Certain parts of education industries and so it's part of that.
Yeah. And I think a lot of other services being provided by our educational infrastructure.
Where does technology or IT fit in?
So part of it is in information, and but part of it is sprinkled throughout. So it's always one of the things. So using what's called the NAICS, we use the NAICS codes. A lot of people might be familiar with SIC codes, but North American Industrial Classification System does not capture new and emerging industries very well. Like there is no category called AI. They typically take 5 to 10 years to really capture what's going on. But for example, there's obviously some IT manufacturing kind of that goes on here. We have a history of big computers here, hard drives, we'll make some hard drives and other things, but it's kind of sprinkled throughout. So it's not called out sort of at this level. This is kind of the highest level. And then you can definitely break out to, this is sort of at the 2-digit level, the 3, 4, 5, 6. But yeah, that's a really good question. And then the other thing, to be honest, in terms of occupations, that's especially IT is throughout all these industries. It's basically almost no industries that don't use IT and won't use AI to go forward. Anything else before I go to the next slide? So we will talk a little bit about this in the SWOT, but we have Orange County is a very diverse community. Like I said, 34 cities, unincorporated areas of the county. That diversity is a great benefit, but also a challenge sometimes. And as Doug was saying, you know, that also applies to the California Jobs First. And for those of you who are on that, you know how diverse the group of people that we brought together there. It does create some interesting discussions, but that's always going to be, something to focus on is how to collaborate across all these different entities in the county. Thank goodness we're not LA County with 88 cities.
That's the right side. So
And then we do think that no one size is going to fit all. So that's why they're, you know, they're drill down strategies. And then Orange County does have a history. So there is a sort of broader historical context. This one, I'm not going to go into these because I'm worried I'm going to be take up your whole morning here. But I'll just go very quickly. Our diverse population means, so we have over 30% of Orange County residents are foreign born. That's a tremendous asset. And you can see global trade is really a big part of Orange County's economy. We have a very highly educated population, especially compared to our neighboring counties here. A little bit less than a couple of the counties up in the Bay Area, but in terms of Southern California, the most highly educated population. We have a lot of world-class educational institution. As I said, this central geographic location is a big benefit, and because of that real focus on like OCTA and others that help the infrastructure system work. Obviously, tourism is a big part of Orange County's economy that historically has been, and we continue to make a lot of investments that are gonna drive tourism to Orange County. So that's what's important about that is that brings dollars into Orange County from outside. So it's the same as like when you export something and you're bringing dollars in. Tourism is, you know, a strange way is sort of like a also an export bringing dollars in. Very diverse economy, as I said. We very typically are 1, 2, or 3 in terms of the national ranking in that. That's really good that when one industry is going down, the rest of them are kind of holding it. And one of the biggest things for those who are on the board at that point, remember when 2008, 2009 hit, and we had a lot of the subprime mortgage lenders here. And Rob can probably remember the WARN notices and that went out, they just imploded within 6 months or so.
Our one stop used to be right next to 3 of them.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden they're all gone.
We were a center of the country.
Yeah. And, Merrickwitz,
yeah,
that was the ground zero.
It started.
So, but relatively, that didn't impact us like you might think if you had a big industry like that. We used to have defense and aerospace used to be almost 100,000 employees here. It's down to less than 20. The other thing, if you lost 80% of your major industry, that would be terrible. But it didn't because of this diversity and some of those. Companies did commercialize their technology into other fields other than defense and aerospace. We have a world-class water system, and then we have very strong broadband infrastructure here in Orange County.
Well, it's just a quick question. Where can we find information about the broadband infrastructure?
It's in that report.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah, there's a map and some analysis about.
The reason I ask is that we're seeing an influx of data centers.
Yeah.
AI want to come into the area. Broadband is key besides power.
Absolutely. And I think that's probably one of the big use cases that's going to absorb some of the office vacancy in data centers. Because a lot of people think maybe housing, but housing, it's most of the time it doesn't make sense. But for data centers, they're perfectly set up for converting that space. So I think we're working on number one there. I think this effort, hopefully, but also California Jobs First is helping that. There's sort of these outdated perceptions, and sometimes we don't get funding because people think that Orange County is like the way it was 30 or 40 years ago. We need to continue to educate people about that. We do continue to have a skills gap. We have a very low unemployment rate. And there's still, even now, although it's down a little bit, job postings, a lot of job postings, you know, jobs for me. Affordable housing is probably our biggest weakness for sure. We can spend all day talking about that. Child care is a big issue. First Five, Orange County, it's a big commitment to addressing that. from drought to earthquakes to, you know, what's going on in San Clemente with the rail line, coastal erosion, California itself, but Orange County specifically being on the coast has to keep an eye on that. We do have some disparities for sure in Orange County. And then those communities also face healthcare outcomes that we need to really keep in mind. So opportunities, you know, to elevate those disinvested communities. This hopefully starts to serve as the regional competitiveness strategy. Orange County has always been an innovation and entrepreneurship place, and I think it will continue to be that. We were just meeting with somebody from the U.S. Department of Commerce, and I was, you know, I kind of knew about it, but the amount of EV companies in Orange County is really amazing. Now. So we need to continue to invest in those clusters and then leverage this international diversity and international connections. Career, I think we need to all know that young people need help, and even you know, incumbent workers need help with career. We need to continue to attract and retain, although I think we've done a pretty good job of that at world-class employers, expand childcare access, and then maintain the key infrastructure of the transportation system, but we do have a mechanism for that. So on those industry clusters, it's interesting to look at the priority clusters for the development board compared to California Jobs First, the CERT. There's actually a lot of interesting overlap there with a few slight differences. So healthcare and social assistance, same. Manufacturing, advanced manufacturing, same. Educational services was one that came to the top in terms of the California Jobs First process. Construction as well has been prioritized by California Jobs First. And then accommodation and food services, very, very much the hospitality tourism. So the differences did not, although IT and technology is a part of manufacturing and everything, that is the one sort of major difference there. And then threats, you know, our aging population, we're over 39 years average age in Orange County. When I started doing this, we're like 32. So we are, that's happening statewide and nationwide, but it's happening faster here. That has a lot of ramifications.
Do you think it's because of the housing expense? It's harder for young people to
see. Yeah, overall cost of living. There's actually an interesting study being done by UC Irvine that I think will be released later in the summer. They did a survey of 800 people and asked them about this. And we got a briefing on it about a few weeks ago. That's largely, yeah. But there's more richer stuff because they additionally interviewed 100 people who had just moved to Orange County and 100 people who had just moved away from Orange County. They did not have that analysis done yet. But that should be really interesting. So the School of Social Ecology at CI will be releasing that, I think, pretty soon. Rising home prices, we just don't build enough. Land's expensive here. We do have a pretty stringent regulatory environment. From like the community indicators that we do and others, there is a mental health crisis. I don't think that's a secret. A big topic, and you know, we could spend all day on the potential AI impacts, but that is going to change the labor market, and it's already started to do that. We've been lucky the last 2 years to have above average rainfall, but that's always going to be an issue, because we are in a drought kind of situation periodically. Climate change impacts, we talked a little bit about that, and then shifting real estate, commercial real estate demand, specifically office, and how we deal with that absorption of that space. In Orange County, it hasn't been as big an issue as it has been like in LA, San Francisco, Seattle. There's actually a thing that Hughes Marina, which is a commercial realty, puts out, which is the availability index, which means not just what's up for lease, but what's up for sublease, because there's a lot of companies that leased a lot of space and then they decided we don't need all this space. So they tried to sublease it. So Orange County is about 19% in terms of availability. LA is about 23% available. San Francisco leads the nation, 33% of office space is available in San Francisco right now. So that's something that we need to figure out, you know, what we're going to do with that space going forward. One change to note. So here's sort of the SED's goals. So education and career to address skills gap, focus on residents living in red zones or disinvested communities, promote those key industry clusters, improve Orange County's economic competitiveness in this global economy. Global trade, I think, is going to continue. It might shift a little bit. There's an amazing amount of investment going on in Mexico right now to do manufacturing. So we'll obviously probably benefit sort of from that. I think we're known as the infrastructure in Orange County is really kind of world-class. This is the one we added since the draft that you've seen, but it is in the one that we are hosting or already posted, is to kind of get back at that collaboration. We decided to develop one, you know, to foster that regional collaboration among economic development and workforce development agencies. And I think there's a nice increasing synergy between those two things going forward. As I said, 56 different proposals for projects. That's really amazing. That shows the richness of, you know, what's going on economically in Orange County, and that obviously for the construction industry, the building trades, this is really great news. When I do the SCAG, we do an economic roundtable of sort of quarterly representatives from all the SCAG counties, which are Orange, LA, Riverside, San Bernardino, Imperial, and Ventura. They would all kill for the pipeline of projects that we have in Orange County. And that's been a big part of holding up our economy here. Our projects like OC5 and the newly approved Disney expansion. It doesn't surprise me, but it's great that we have all these proposed projects because that just brings jobs, good paying jobs, and that creates these kind of multiplier or ripple effects. And I said, the evaluation framework, we just kept the current one from last time that we had developed, but this allows you to, you know, kind of prioritize this 56 projects in terms of what you might want to move forward at the sort of county level. So I think that's it. Love to take any questions or comments. It's been fascinating re-looking. Having done this, this is the fourth one I think I've done. There's been a lot of changes in Orange County, mostly for the better. We actually, I'll just say one other anecdote that this is the 25th, this will be the 25th year of the Community Indicator Report. So I went back, I actually was able to get the 1999 report electronically. I don't have a hard copy, unfortunately. And so much progress across the board in terms of the economy, in terms of the environment, in terms of education. The one thing is housing. Housing was a big issue in 1999, and it continues to be probably the biggest issue that's kind of holding us back. So last thing I'll say is, so for 3 years from 2020, 2021, 2022, we actually lost population in Orange County. The new numbers just came out about 3 weeks ago, and we actually gained population in 2023. So we've been losing about 15,000 per year on average for those 3 years. We actually gained about 10,000. So hopefully that's the start of a swing back up. And that's it. Love to take any questions or comments. Thank you so much. Great question.
Thank you so much for your time. Are there any other questions or comments or feedback? Just a note regarding housing. Saw the list of projects, which are excellent. And then there were three projects for housing, which is probably more than that in the pipeline development. So kind of like having that alignment as to all this growth, job opportunities, but they're not having the opportunity to have people live here as well.
What do you feel are the major changes from the last sense to this sense?
Yeah, well, the two things that stick out really to me is we're making progress in terms of the number of red zones. That's down, you know, about 30 or 40% if you take on a percentage basis. And the number of projects that are being put forward.
Yeah.
That's a huge leap. I have to go back and see how many were in the last one, but nowhere near 56. So I think great job on the outreach to cities, but also if there's a lot going on right now, and it's really impressive at a time when, you know, interest rates and mortgage rates are still somewhat elevated, that we have all these projects that are sort of in the pipeline. Oh, that's a change from the federal government. The economic resilience and climate resilience are two new sections that are required by the EDA guidelines.
All right. Well, thank you again. So at this time, we'll move over to our action items on the agenda. The first one is item 7. We just heard the presentation, and we need to act on the 2024-2029 sets, and staff recommends that we review and support staff's recommendation to submit the 2024-2029 sets to the Orange County Board of Supervisors and file submission to the Economic Development Administration, or EDA, including any non-substantive changes and updates. I'll entertain a motion.
So moved.
Moved by Doug. Is there a second? Yes. Second by Gloria. Any discussion? I'll call to a vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion carries. Thank you. Congratulations. All right, move on to item 8, policy updates. And for that, we need staff support. Let's go on with ABC. Cal's jobs participating in point timeline policy. ABC.
On page 5 of your packet, we go kind of the summary background for you to see the flips. So the first one is A, the CalJobs participant reporting timeline policy. The EDD submits accurate participant reports and validated individual data to the Department of Labor quarterly and annually. So CalJobs is the California system of record that streamlines intake and case management for RIO Title I programs, emphasizing a data entry timeline. So Francis has some background on all policy revisions.
Yeah, so nothing substantial. Basically, there's been 2 workforce service directives updated since the policy, so we've revised those, added those as reference documents. We've also kind of cleaned up the language a little bit. We did also add in the 6 indicators of performance reference those in there, which is employment rate after the 2nd quarter, employment rate after the 4th quarter, so medium income, sprint provision attainment, measurable skills gain, and then enrollment numbers to make sure that information is captured in there. But like I said, it's nothing substantial. It's just kind of beating up the reference documents to make sure that the language is ready.
The second policy is the financial literacy policy, an update to the ITA policy. The financial literacy education refers to activities that provide individuals with the knowledge and skills that they need to achieve long-term financial stability. The policy revisions outlined are kind of revise the sequence. And so it's not a mandate by WIOA that people have to take it, but it should be offered. Currently in the policy, and it's like an internal, it's not region-wide, is that they must complete this financial literacy course of like 10 modules before we'll let them move on to ITA training. And so the feedback that I've heard in the community is that's a huge barrier. Mm-hmm. So when they're looking for a job, they don't want to complete this module before they go to training. They want to find a job. So in talking to kind of some stakeholders, we visited the law, and it's not mandated in terms of sequence. So we are still offering it, but we're moving that provision that they have to complete it before they go into training. Right. They do it concurrently. They don't have to do it at all, but we do offer it. And so that's the main revision. And then the ITA policy, it just mentions that they have to complete that. So we wanted to revise both. So those are the changes for the individual training account policy. So that was brought to the board prior to increase the cap to 10,000. So this would be, you know, kind of something that we required them to do, but we're removing that sequence. That's the only change there. Currently, Anaheim Workforce Development Board, we're aligning with them because they don't require that sequence. And so we're just trying to regionally get on the same page. That's that one. The last policy is the CalJobs data change request policy. Service providers for WIO Title I programs must report participant information via CalJobs. Manager, staff, and MIS administrators can change active participant data, but after 30 days, certain areas are locked. And so, that's some background on SWAR.
Yes, much like the participant reporting timeline, we're updating the reference documents to the Workforce Service Directives, which are a little bit outdated. There's been changes. Also, the states had some additional reporting requirements. Information, participant information previously captured on the old form to be added so that way we aren't capturing that information. So that's been addressed. And then also it clearly defines like the reporting direction, like who they report to. This way the program managers are aware of what's going on with the contracts they're overseeing.
So staff's recommendation is to support these updates to the OCWDB policies, including any non-substantive changes and updates, including references to these policies and existing policies.
Thank you, Nancy and Francis, for the background. I'll go ahead and entertain a motion to approve staff's recommendations relative to item 8 and C. Moved by Karen, is there a second?
Second.
Second by Doug. Any discussion on any of the items?
Question.
Yes.
The financial literacy, do we have like any data that says as a policy and mandatory compared to the other workforce boards that didn't have it, that shows our participants benefited from it or do better in any way?
It's a very small cohort. So we're looking at kind of, there's a track for CNA nursing through one of the ROP programs, and they both submitted like about 25 individuals, and they all moved forward in the Anaheim WIP and have moved forward in ours. So just kind of taking that and expanding, talking to different stakeholders, had the same feedback. So we're hoping that moves there.
Okay, George and McCoy.
My question is on items 8B. I noticed you removed the adult dislocated worker programs policy section and youth and young adult programs policy section. Is there, you may have mentioned it while you're explaining it, but was there, is that policy elsewhere, or is it?
No, just across the board, you do make it offered, and we do offer, but it's not mandated in those spaces.
Okay, but what was there, what was the?
Previously, we made everyone that wanted to go into the IT training complete these modules prior to, so it's more the sequence of what's in these programs.
So that was just for clarification. It is mandated, like now is the time they could take it.
It's not mandated anymore.
Okay, I was confused.
Yeah, but they say it should be offered.
So it should be offered, but it's an option.
That's for the youth, I think sometimes people put it as part of the program, as part of these 14 elements, but I mean, sequence is more what we're addressing than kind of the thing we're not making it work.
Yes, when we get to the point where we're not mandating, people are moving forward, I think it would be very interesting to capture the data around the people who actually finish, do they have better outcomes? So I think that would be a really useful data point at some point. I'm fine with it's not mandated.
Yeah.
But and you know, I think mandating, it's just a barrier for people that we need to get them into jobs. But we might encourage more if we actually know that the outcomes are better.
Absolutely.
That might help with the education programming that we might have in the future. Mm-hmm. It was a big topic of conversation when we went to the master education plan. Some of us had the ability to be there. And the conversation came up in several workshops about home ed not being available. So who's teaching our incoming workforce, how to save, how to invest.
We'll collect that data, absolutely.
Yes, for the actual curriculum, has that been changed?
Everything stays the same, but it's more the sequence and the mandate, like prior to accessing all these services.
Spirit of data, maybe that's something we could do is look into the MoneySmart curriculum and see if there's anything else or method.
That's a glorious point. I do like the notion of filling the gap relative to youth education and financial literacy.
Right. Because
if there's a time to figure it out or learn it,
discussion.
Any other comments, thoughts, feedback, questions? All right, hearing none, I'm going to call it to a vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion carries. Yes. All right, so we'll go ahead and move on to the final set of items, informational items. So I'm going to go ahead and start with the chair's report. We had a District 1 career fair in May. And I'm happy to report that there were 49 employers who attended. Some of us were there. And this was held in the city of Garden Grove, which has a lot of projects pitched in our sets. The city manager was there as well. We had 232 job seekers who attended. So thank you for the staff for the tremendous outreach. The OC Workforce Solutions was busy at all times. A lot of resumes were printed. A lot of resumes were reviewed. Multiple employers commented that this is the best career fair they've ever attended. Congratulations. Thank you. Did see a variety and another diverse group of employers there as compared to those G3, like Forest. 20 out of 39 employers who have responded to our survey thus far said that they have scheduled interviews and or made employment offers to attendees. And that's a really wonderful note for us. People always asking, what's the outcome and what's the result and how many people actually got their careers launched or continued as a result of these events. Did you have a comment or question? Oh, great. Upcoming events. We have a rapid response virtual webinar, second ones we have each month, I believe, Zero Flyer, here so. Oh, not that.
You have.
So second Wednesday of each month from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. Any questions about that, feel free to reach out to Nancy. We do have 6 hiring events, including a hiring event in partnership with the Department of Rehabilitation. Thank you so much, Sherry. That is on June 6th. Feel free to reach out, support, attend if you'd like to, if you're interested. There's a career exploration event on June 12th with the Iron Workers 433 and Gettle. Did I say that right? Thank you so much. For that support, and the Disneyland information event on June 25th. Thank you so much, Kathy. Another update regarding events, Southern California Regional Rapid Response Roundtable hosted by the Workforce Development Board. We do have a flyer in the project for that. We have, including our speakers, Mike Daniel, who's on our board, and Dr. Walz Walrod, who will be there as well. So please feel free to support or inquire about that. Our next Orange County Workforce Development Board meeting is on June 26th, we believe we're halfway through the year, and it will be in South County at the Laguna Niguel Workforce Center, our fairly new center in South Orange County. If you have any specific scheduling conflicts, we do recognize that life and career have to come first. Please give us advance notice. That is helpful to us as we plan and prepare, because quorum is critically important for us in order for us to conduct the business. We will at that meeting be reviewing our updated bylaws revisions and proposals. And I want to give a shout out to our bylaws ad hoc committee consisting of Rob Claudio and Kathy Boyd. We met a total of 4 times in the spring to go over some proposed bylaw revisions and amendments. Thank you for that. We will have a report out for our conferences that we have attended in the spring. That's the National Association of Workforce Boards. And then today, a few of us will be going to the desert for the California Workforce Association. So Gloria, Andrew, myself will be there along with staff. So we will share with you some findings around that. And then just a reminder around attendance, thank you all for being here. We really appreciate it. Thank you for always responding to quorum calls. And thank you for the staff for making sure that we have the attendance that we need. Again, always feel free to reach out to myself or to Nancy if you ever have any questions, any comments, feedback, or have a conversation that is within our guidelines of the Brown Act. And if you ever have any anticipated absences or questions around that, feel free to reach out. We really, really appreciate your time and your support as we continue to move forward Welcome again to the fairly new board members. Thank you for the continued support of our existing board members as well. That concludes my chair report. I'll go ahead and turn it over to our director.
Thank you, Chair. A few quick program updates. Bob Lantern from the California Workforce Association has retired. Moved on after 13 years serving as the executive director. Yeah, so let me bring that great news to you. No one's been confirmed as a replacement, but there is an interim in C. The other program update, we did get our funding notices from the state, and as anticipated due to the low unemployment rate, region-wide, all three workforce boards did get cuts in funding. So the Anaheim Workforce Board has a reduction of 7.7% in their overall funding. The Santa Ana Workforce Board is an overall reduction of 4.7%. And then for us, it's a 6.9% reduction in funding to the total of about $842,000 over one. See, and then we move to our performance updates, which is the last page of your agenda packet. So the first for the center stats, increasing, visitors are increasing. We have the comprehensive center, the downstairs, Francis, do you want to talk about the
social?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's actually today, they're doing the press conference, ribbon cutting ceremony downstairs. So it's SSA and basically a holistic one-stop shop for their services. And there's also going to be a small contingent of a healthcare agency in there as well. So we're actually very excited for it. So a lot of the populations that program serve, we also serve. And so we should have a very good symbiotic relationship where we've got a nice referral stream up and downstairs, if you will, where when they're done soliciting their services, they can come up to us, shop our services, and see if we have great employment. So that's going on today. That's Vice Chief is going to be
tomorrow.
Oh, tomorrow. Sorry. Yes, tomorrow. So I should be there along with a lot of representation from the county. We will be also conducting tours upstairs for press who want to see the SSA also. So if you want to go down, you can swim by and say hi.
That's exciting. Do I have a question? Will there be active cross-referrals?
Yes. So I had a meeting with Social Service Agency yesterday, trying to work out streamline the referral process. For us, it's no wrong door. You can come anytime.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't need an appointment. But they are maybe wanting to do a warm handoff, so we'll go into that.
So I have just one thing, and this is related to the public transit. So there's a bus stop, and I've noticed that it's not active, and it's the one right next to Placentia and Imperial Highway, which is the closest bus stop to our facility, and it's not a stop. The kiosk is there, but the bus doesn't stop. So I don't know who we could follow up with OCTA. As to the why, because maybe it wasn't utilized enough, years ago, and they stopped. But I'm like, well, that's our closest, bus stop. Anybody on public transportation, it's really close to the facility. But otherwise, they have to go down past the Trader Joe's on Imperial Highway then come back.
Thank you for talking.
Yeah,
it's actually a good point. I was thinking about transportation as well, and linkages. And I don't know that we collect data right now as to how people get to the center. Are they driving or are they using public transportation? Get a sense of what that might be like. It takes a long time to get from one part of the county, especially if a lot of the corridor that you mentioned earlier, that's clear back, which probably good power.
We can look into that. Thank you. Okay, the second section is business services. So overall, the last quarter, we served over 194 employers and 3,000 job seekers through our hiring events, career events, incumbent worker trainings, on-the-job trainings, and work experience projects. There have been an increase in WARN notices between January and March. We received kind of the highest number yet of the quarters. Some of the, which I think Todd had asked before, the businesses, also the top five, I'm bringing that to you, is Tower Semiconductor. 699 people were affected. Activision Blizzard, 479 individuals affected. Saffron, 282. NSI Logistics, 198 employees, and Rivian Automotive, 191 employees. So we are continuously getting those warm notices, and our team will go out and do the rapid response and bring the services to.
Just a moment on the parking factors. I understand that's a temporary thing. They're just laying them off while they're, because they've had a decrease in production.
Okay.
So I don't know how we handle that differently.
We would still go out and give resources if they wanted to upskill or, you know, bring all the same resources up. Yeah.
I think Blizzard was because of a merger with Microsoft.
A lot of mergers.
That's in the IT sector.
Yeah.
That's the AI. It's a reverse.
Right. And thank you to Todd. He's really introduced us to some of the businesses that he's working with, and we've been able to develop like work experience and on-the-job training. So
I appreciate that connection
that we
have. I'm very happy.
Yeah. Oh, good. Nice to hear. Okay. So for a program for adults for the last quarter, goal was 404. Our total overall goal is 426. So in the last 2 months, we don't anticipate any problems reaching this. The median quarterly earning was exceeded the goal. For dislocated worker, we are at 244 in goal. We're a little bit shy of the overall goal, and we're seeing kind of statewide. It's assessing data on the dislocated workers.
Yeah, so dislocated workers has been received layoff notification. I've been recently laid off. As you can see, like statewide, the quarter unemployment was low, and at Orange County, it's about 1% lower than the state. So, you know, as Dr. Walden was kind of referencing, there's less unemployment in Orange County, which just means that that pool of dislocated workers will be certain small. So that's leading to lower enrollment numbers.
That is it for the adult program. I have two success stories for you. One participant was completing her nursing assistant through a different academy through the help of WIOA. We helped her purchase scrubs and do job placement services, and she's currently actively employed at a health clinic. The second one is single mom, justice involved, looking to change her career path. Was really interested in truck driving training program. So through our training program, we did put her in there, and she earned her Class A license, and let's see, she secured a position with a reputable transportation company. So she is also currently. For the veteran services, 37 enrolled in the last quarter. The overall target is 150, and we're currently at 153. So we've reached and exceeded that target. For the veterans, so this individual, after separating from the military, was really interested in pursuing a job as a security analyst in the military branch that he was in. He served as an intelligence analyst, making minimum wage. So during the assessment, we enrolled him in ITA to upskill, and he currently finished the training and has received a position as a security analyst 3 with an annual salary of $96,000. So we were able to enroll him in that policy that you guys changed to increase that ITA cap to put him in these training. So that's fantastic. For the youth, we have 489 enrolled last quarter. They're on track to meeting their placement goals. For a success story, we have an in-school story. My vision's bad. So he was provided employment training through work experience at an investment company in San Juan Capistrano, helped him get enrolled in Saddleback College, which he finished, and then he transferred to California State Fullerton and began his studies in business management. He kept in touch with us because he still needed employment during school, came to a hiring event, got employment with Disney, and he continues to thrive there. He finished his internship with his Fullerton County department. We helped him with his resume, and he's pursuing jobs in the business. But his quote was, "My short-term and long-term goals learned through Ready, Set, OC really helped me find community, college, and college resources, organize my time, and effectively communicate with people in my teamwork situations." So he's very grateful for his experience. California Jobs, or not California Jobs, sorry, California Youth Challenge. They're having their graduation on June 8th at Long Beach Community College. So I think our youth chair, anyone's interested, I think.
Thank you so much, Nancy. Really appreciate your hard work. Francis, rest of the team, really love the infographics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Love the success stories and want to let more people know beyond this room about the kind of impact that you all are making as a result of the policies that you're improving and the work the staff is doing. That's amazing. It's just kind of like one life at a time, but then you multiply that and it's big. Thank you for your time and your dedication. I think we are at the end of our agenda. So unless there are any other comments, questions, feedback, Michelle, someone. Yes.
The flyers that I was banned on whiting for recently, those can come in your email to us. I love those. They're really easy for me to hand out to my staff and message along. So if you can include those, I'd
Okay. Perfect.
Yes, Kim.
So I hope this is okay, but this, I don't want to get from the Brown Act, Workforce Development Board staff has been attending a sort of non-traditional apprenticeship conference, which are for non-traditional, but it could be anything. I've been very involved. I typically am on a panel. Our company has been sponsoring this. And so this is for kind of the non-skilled trades apprentices and going beyond internship, where people are in school, I'll say typically community colleges, and they're working 3 days a week and in school 2 days a week. The employer finances the school, and they graduate with live experience and very typically jobs. So I just wanted to let people know that there's a group working on that, and you could communicate with the staff about, oh, if you know companies who might be interested, they can get you connected.
And that is the good point, because what's missing in this typically, the building trades been doing this for 100 years, and we have the relationship with the employer. And what's always been missing in non-traditional apprenticeships is none of the employers wanted to pony up or step up to train their workforce. They relied on the community colleges.
Right.
So just hearing this, that's a direction it has to take. The employers have to realize we have a stake in this. And the going to school and working, those are old. In the 50s and 60s, they had jobs works programs. You went to school half the day and worked in an office building. They did that in New York for years,
yep.
This is great. It's good to hear.
Yeah, and it's for anyone who knows of employers who might be interested, there is a group inside Orange County that if you're an employer says, I'm interested in talking to you about apprentices, they will show up on site and help you put a program together. And it's all free.
So, yes, we need to catch up here when it comes to apprenticeships, but not traditional ones. So thank you for that. Yes.
And speaking with Doug, we want to try to bring one of his labor use speakers to talk about kind of traditional apprenticeships. I think
So everybody gets a feel for exactly what the term means. And it's not internships, it's work and learn and get educated, and the employer does have a stake in all that, helping its own workforce. You know. But yes, we will do that.
Okay.
We're working with the apprenticeship to see if June's going to think it will.
Great. Thank you again, Dr. Walswell-Rudd, for being here.
I'm going to encourage you, if you are part of the CERC or Jobs First or whatever, to really engage. We are at the stage where proposals are going to be coming and we're going to be selecting those proposals and putting it very positively. We want to encourage the proposals to really be careers so that it's not just a job. And there are some proposals, and I'm not saying it's wrong, I'm just saying, how are you going to be able to make it a career when you're talking about urban farming? Yeah.
especially in Orange County. That is not something that will carry you into a career unless, you know, you're a college and you get certification, right? So we want to encourage everybody to really voice it out, because I know the House of Labor is telling and talking about apprenticeships and the importance of being part of them, because, you know, it leads to a career path. It leads to good paying jobs and a safety net. That's the verbiage we're using to encourage all of the other organizations out there. But as always, we need support and we need voices to actually echo that message so that the funding actually means good paying jobs. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Yes, absolutely. Okay, any other comments, questions? Hearing none, we'll see some of you in the desert. Otherwise, we'll see all of you in June. Good one. He is a German.